This is Terry Finneman. Today is June 25th, 2020. I am interviewing Letty Lister, the president and publisher of the Black Hills Pioneer in Spearfish, South Dakota, for the Community Journalism in Middle America, Challenges and Innovations of COVID-19 Coverage Oral History Project. So, Letty, start out telling us a little bit about your career in journalism, how long you've worked in the industry, and what you've done.
Sure. I graduated from Kansas State University in December of 1988 with a journalism degree, and I also had an emphasis in agricultural economics as well as graphic design. And so my ultimate goal was to work in journalism for the agricultural industry. I worked for the newspaper there in Manhattan, Kansas, called the Manhattan Mercury, while I was in college. And that's owned by the Seton family, and they purchased that paper in 1915. And over the years, they had purchased other small community papers throughout Kansas, Nebraska, here in South Dakota, and even Wyoming. They offered me a job here in Spearfish right out of college, and I thought that would be a great opportunity for me to get some experience in community journalism. And so I thought I'd be here for about 5 years, and I fell in love with the place. And 31 years later, I'm still here. So I worked my way up through the newspaper, started off in actually advertising sales, and then ad manager, and then went on to general manager. And then in 2010, I became the publisher of the newspaper.
And what is your newspaper circulation?
We are right around 5,000 households with hard copy circulation. And then we have another 370 some, give or take a little bit, for e-editions or electronic service, electronic subscriptions for the paper.
How many people are there in the newsroom?
We have 10 reporters in our newsroom.
So let's talk specifically about the pandemic. When did the impact of COVID-19 on your newspaper begin?
Our first cases in South Dakota actually occurred on the other side of the state in Sioux Falls, and there were 5 cases on March 10th. A week later, by March 17th, we had made the determination that we needed to close our office down to the public and start moving as many of our workers to work from home as we could while still producing our paper. We made a decision years ago to really go aggressively after print jobs. So we not only print our own paper, but we print several weekly papers for other publishers. We print grocery store inserts for grocery store chains that are local and regional grocery stores. So we had to really strike a balance of trying to get people that could work remotely and more safely to do so while still keeping our doors open, because we had to keep producing the product.
So I asked you about the newsroom count, but how many people total work at the newspaper whose jobs were disrupted?
We have a total of 40 full-time employees at that point. And then another half dozen or so part-time employees, and then we have just under 100 carriers. The carriers are not employees, they're contract labor, but they're still impacted by us.
So with all these people in such different roles, you know, how have you had employees adjust their routines during the pandemic?
Well, in the newspaper business, you have to be flexible, and we certainly have had many disruptors over the years, so we're kind of used to being flexible and able to adjust to whatever curveball might be thrown at us, so to speak. So the major adjustments, I would say, for us initially were being able to communicate our newsroom goals and story strategies and that kind of stuff. Being able to do that when you don't have people physically together. We really rely on that, what happens in a newsroom and that gelling of ideas and how to approach a story, keeping it fair and balanced. If somebody is kind of going off where we think, you know, they shouldn't be, then we can bring them back and you can discuss interviews you've had. And we've lost that interaction with the majority of our reporters now. We did have reporters that had some underlying health issues, so that became a factor for us. So those folks, we made sure we got them working from home right away. But we've learned how to use our technology to stay in communication. And we're using Zoom meetings, things like that, where we can at least see each other. And we have those, we've always had a weekly news meeting in person where we had all reporters come in, whether they were full-time employees of ours or if they were, a contract stringer, we would have them come in to gather and plan our agenda for the week. So we just do that by Zoom now. And we do find that we're talking a lot more, texting a lot more, and emailing a lot more. And our news cycle has always been 24 hours, but there was always a little bit of a downtime. And then we would have one person on call. But I would say one of the other major differences is that it kind of feels like we're on call all the time now, 7 days a week. There's always something new happening or breaking. So,
did you designate anyone in specific to stay in the newsroom, or is everyone working remotely?
We have our editor works in the newsroom. One of our sports reporters who moved over to covering news because there are no high school sports or college sports right now. He moved into a news position, so he stayed. He comes into the office for breaking news, like a fire or an accident, something like that. We have one other reporter that lives up in Lead, which is a smaller community about 15 minutes from here. Then he comes into the newsroom every day as well to cover Spearfish, and then our page layout person that lays out the pages each day for the newspaper is here every day. Then all of the other ones are out and working from home.
What rules did you put in place for the newspaper as far as any kind of safety regulations, as far as people going when they do have to go out, as far as any kind of photography or any kind of in-person interactions?
We have really limited in-person interactions. We were early adopters of the social distancing. So the first thing we did internally is we spaced everyone in the building out that was still coming into the building. And then from there, we added, we've always had hand sanitizer in our office, but we added numerous more stations. We've tripled the number of hand sanitizer stations that we have. We Lysol everything down morning and night, and then throughout the day, we wipe things down. We wipe down keyboards, phones. The employees are told that they are not allowed to use each other's equipment. They can only use their own equipment, so we don't get any cross-contamination that way. We have been able to get anywhere from 10 to 12 feet between employees. So we are not requiring masks in the office. But they are required to wear a mask when they go outside of the office and they're working for us, just because we don't know what situation they're going to get into and we want them to have a mask on.
So I'm really glad that you brought up earlier the printing part of the newspaper and how critical that is. So obviously you have your guys who need to work in the press room itself to print all of these papers. So what kind of practices do you have in place there?
So another portion of what we've learned about how this virus spreads is that air exchange and air movement really helps kill the particles. So our back shop where our presses are, we have two large garage doors. And so we make sure those are open. And they are open a lot anyway throughout the day with insert deliveries, newsprint deliveries coming in, or us sending papers out. So we have a lot of air exchange, which we know is good, and that helps back there. They do work closer together on the press and on our insert machine in our mailroom. So all of those workers are required to wear masks and make sure that they social distance. And we just remind everybody every day, don't touch your face, wash your hands, put your mask on. We have purchased numerous masks here for our employees, just about any shape, size, kind you can imagine, because we want to make sure that they find something they're comfortable with. And we know that we're in this for the long haul. You know, our assumption is we're going to have to practice this for a year or more. And so I want to make sure that it's not a financial burden for people to have masks. And I want to make sure they have one that's comfortable so that they'll wear it. And then we're supplying, obviously, multiple masks for each employee. And in addition to that, it was really hard to purchase hand sanitizer early on. And because we're in a rural area, we tend to get supplies later, or we're at the end of the supply chain, so to speak. So we started purchasing hand sanitizer through the company by gallon distribution. And so we've told all employees to bring their personal hand sanitizer bottles back in when they get empty, and we'll refill them for them for free so they can take those home or have them on their desk or whatever they want to do. My main thing is that they are not only feel safe, but I want them to be safe. So those are some of the things that we've implemented throughout the building.
I'm also glad that you mentioned newspaper carriers a little bit ago, because that's, I think, another interesting angle. So for a brief second at the beginning of this pandemic, there was concern about, you know, surfaces and potentially spreading the virus through surfaces, and concern, well, newspapers, could that spread the virus? That was very quickly debunked. But was that ever a brief concern for you?
Oh, absolutely. Almost an immediate concern. Once I made sure that our office was safe and that our employees were safe, I was, you know, immediately on to that, because I wanted our customers to be safe and our carriers to be safe. So I did a lot of reading, and the World Health Organization was very helpful with that, with getting information back out to us. But even though we knew that we were safe, we have to communicate that to our carriers and to our customers. So we produced handouts that we could give to our carriers. We communicated with them by phone and through our normal messaging systems. And then we ran ads. And then we did an outsert flyer that goes on the outside of every paper that was delivered to our customers that explained that the papers are very porous, therefore the virus doesn't last on those. And the newsprint's very sanitary as well. And then we've provided gloves and hand sanitizer for all of our carriers, even though they're contracted. And I know that I keep bringing that term up, but there is a difference between an employee and a contractor. And we're not bound to provide supplies for them, but the fact is they're critical to what we do. And so we wanted to make sure that they felt safe and that they were practicing good hygiene and prevention. So that's what we've done for the carriers and then for our customers too. And really, we got a few phone calls, but that was about it. Everybody was mostly supportive of us, making sure that we communicated to them that they didn't have to worry about the handling of the paper by them or by us. And one of the other things that we suggested too, if they did have any concerns, was to just let their paper sit for a little bit and it would be fine.
Give us a little bit of context as far as what the pandemic is like in your community. You know, how many cases have there been there so far?
So we've been pretty lucky where we're at. Our paper is small, but we cover a pretty big geographic area. And then we are the legal newspaper for five towns and three counties.
Tell us what those towns and counties are.
In Lawrence County, our main base, where our plant is and where our business office is, all in one, is in Spearfish. And then we cover the towns of Lead and Deadwood, Whitewood, and St. Ange. Then in Butte County to our north, we are the legal paper for the county and for the city of Belle Fourche, Nisland, and Newell. And then in Meade County, we are the legal paper for that county and the city of Sturgis. Back to your question about the COVID numbers and how they've impacted us here. This is very much, we're a shopping hub here in Spearfish, and so we supply ranchers and rural folks from a long ways away. Our trade area, it's not unusual for someone to drive 90 miles to come here and shop at a Walmart or a grocery store. And they'll buy a month to a month and a half's worth of supplies all at once. So it's a little deceiving on numbers, but for Lawrence County, as of today, we have 17 confirmed COVID cases with 12 recovered. But five of those have come in the last week and a half. So we're starting to see the influx come in. In Butte County, there are zero. In Meade County, there are 43 COVID cases with 34 recovered and one death. And then in Pennington County, which is where Rapid City is, which is about a 50 miles away, and that's the major trade hub. They have 475 cases with 317 recovered and 12 deaths. So as the population increases in the county, there are more cases. And so we haven't been impacted strongly yet, but we know that it's coming because we're very much a tourist-oriented community. We have legalized gaming in Deadwood. And when Las Vegas shut down, we had airplane loads of people literally coming in to gamble in Deadwood. We're seeing lots of out-of-state tags right now, lots of campers coming through. And I mean, that's kind of typical for us this time of year because we have a large tourism season. We're definitely seeing a spike from the states that have been hit hard, which makes everybody nervous. And I have some more about that that I can talk about later too.
So going off of that, why don't you talk about South Dakota more broadly? Because South Dakota took a little bit more of an open approach to the pandemic than some other states.
We never had a shutdown in South Dakota. Back on March 17th, when our office closed, pretty much within the next, it was kind of a domino effect. Within that next 48 hours or so, the restaurants closed down voluntarily. The restaurants closed down. The casinos all closed down up in Deadwood. Hotels closed. Everybody just kind of shut down. The schools closed, sent kids home. To kind of take a wait and see approach on what we should do. The way the governor Noem handled it here for the state of South Dakota is she allowed each of the communities, she allowed them to decide, make the decision what they wanted to do. If they wanted to have a more restricted movement, access, and business. And so that became up to the mayors and the city councils, which was at times kind of a struggle, was our observation, because they had to figure it out on their own. They were instructed to go to the CDC websites and use that, their recommendations for moving forward, which is pretty much what everybody did. Some of our mayors and city councils, I would give, you know, a B plus or A minus to. Some of them, I feel like, kind of failed their citizens. They didn't do anything to try to help give guidelines to the retail businesses on what to do and how to do it. We have a mix here. We have a lot of locally owned and operated businesses. And then we have chain stores that are here too. We have a really large Walmart Supercenter that's just across the road, literally from us here at the newspaper. They never shut down, which was good because people were still able to get supplies. The grocery stores didn't shut down, but restaurants really were thrown a curveball. They tended to start following what the national chains were doing. We do have an Applebee's and a Perkins and a Kentucky Fried Chicken and some pizza chains. And so really, it looked to me like each industry was kind of figuring it out on their own on what to do. But things got very, very quiet around here for sure. And then activity just started gradually coming back. So restaurants around here did curbside service. They've just reopened to dining here in the last 2 weeks or so, and they've removed tables and have outside seating, things like that, which has been okay for us here because the weather's good, but we do have long winters, so I'm curious what will happen this fall when people have to be back inside again. So just overall for the state itself, people were very respectful of trying to be cautious. They were not wearing masks much at first, but I've definitely seen an increase in people wearing masks when they're out in public, which has been good to see, because really everyone's main concern was to try to keep the healthcare system from being overloaded and overrun. So overall, our economy certainly took a hit, but we've been able to kind of keep progressing and moving along. The casino is completely shut down and then reopened about 5 weeks later, I believe was how long they're closed, right around there, 5 to 6 weeks in that range.
So going back to your mention of tourists, your newspaper is the Black Hills Pioneer. You are a major tourist area. We're doing this interview on June 25th. What is tourism looking like these first few weeks of summer?
It's a really mixed bag. I can tell you Deadwood casino numbers, and that might be more helpful than just a straight tourist number. So they'll be kind of anecdotal. But for Deadwood itself, there's always a comparison of the monthly pull is what they call it, or the amount of money gambled and then they compare that to the year previous. So we just got our May numbers compared to May numbers of last year. And the total amount of money spent or gambled was down only 14% in Deadwood. That surprised us, given the fact that there's not a lot of movement. But when you go up to Deadwood, the parking lots are full at all the casinos. Their hotel reservations were down 19%. So people are still coming in for that. We are not seeing the crunch that we would normally see, but we're just getting into our major events that we have. Next week being the 4th of July, we have a large rodeo in Belle Fourche to our north. And that's a PRCA or Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association rodeo. They would normally have 350 to 400 contestants, and they have registered as of now over 1,200 contestants.
Oh my goodness.
Mm-hmm. And part of the reason is most of the rodeos have canceled all of the major rodeos in Wyoming have canceled. And so those cowboys are coming here because we're still having ours. They have not made any adjustments for seating, which makes all of us a little bit nervous. They have reserved seating and they're not spacing them out in the grandstands, but they think that they're outside so that they'll be safe. We do have, as a newspaper, we do have, you know, and an observer of how they're proceeding, we see some issues with that. A lot of those cowboys are talking about staying because there's two more events in the next 2 weeks. So that will definitely be a major influx for us. Next weekend as well, on July 3rd, President Trump plans to be at Mount Rushmore, and Governor Noem had invited him to come and celebrate the Independence Weekend here. And they're talking about having fireworks at Mount Rushmore, which normally they don't. It's rare that they do that anymore because of the concerns of forest fires. And there's been a lot of people have come out opposed to that, and they're planning on having them anyway. But we know that that's going to bring in, there's 7,500 tickets for that spoken for right now already. The concerns about the fires, of course, is that you have to have your first responders ready and your healthcare community ready in case there's anything catastrophic with those fires. So it's just one more pressure in addition to COVID on our healthcare community and our first responders. The other big event that we have coming up is the Sturgis Motorcycle Rally, and that's a world renowned motorcycle rally for motorcycle enthusiasts. And this year is the 80th annual. There was a lot of debate about whether to go ahead and have it or not. A typical crowd for that brings in just under 500,000 people for the motorcycle rally. And when there's a major anniversary, that number usually spikes. And we've seen as high as 1 million people come in for that motorcycle rally. And Sturgis is one of the towns that we cover, and it's about 15 miles from our plant right here. And the entire area fills up, campgrounds, hotels, houses, people rent houses, everything. On June 15th, the city of Sturgis City Council decided to go ahead and go forward with the rally in a modified format. But they are still trying to figure that out and how they're going to do it. And really the scary part of that is that those rally goers come from all over the nation and they're older. And so they're right in the bullseye of this virus. So we have some real concerns with that too. People getting sick while they're here and overloading our healthcare system and or possibly bringing the virus with them, and then our low numbers are going to go out the window. So there's certainly a lot of anxiety and apprehension about that. But those are some of the major events coming up that bring in a lot of people. And I probably should mention as well, the entire state population of South Dakota is 800,000. And so when you're bringing in, you almost double the population of your state. It causes a lot of logistical issues, let alone having it occur during a pandemic.
Talk a little more about how you have personally adjusted to working in journalism during the pandemic, as far as, you know, trying to work with other family members around and getting your home office set up. And just what has that adjustment been like for you?
Well, I've never stopped coming into the office. I've been in the office every single day, as well as so is the core part of our employee group. There's about 18 of us that have been in the office every single day since it began. I can tell you a little bit about what's happened with them. As you know, of course, it's been very difficult for people that have kids that are in grade school age, because they still need to be supervised, but they still had to do their homework. And there was a lot of expectations put on them by our schools that the parents could help the kids get all the homework done. Plus, they're still trying to work. So that was proved to be very difficult. We've always been very open to letting employees bring their kids into the office if they want to. So initially, we told them if they felt safe doing it, they certainly were welcome to bring their kids in so that their kids could work on their homework while our employees were doing their work. And we had three kids that came in with three separate families, did do that for the first few weeks. And then they found alternative ways to take care of them and do that. Myself personally, my kids are in college. One goes to school here. He'll be a senior this coming fall, studying English at Black Hill State University. It didn't impact him a whole lot. He just switched to being online. So it was pretty easy transition for him. But he did start working more and helping us more out here at the newspaper. He works in our back shop. And then our daughter attends Kansas State University, and she's studying kinesiology, so she's in the medical profession, health profession. She had come back for spring break, and right when all this hit, and they extended her spring break by a week, which she thought was pretty great, and then they said, no, you're not coming back at all, and then she didn't think that was all that great. So she had to make pretty major adjustments, figuring out how to do everything online, get it done on time, switching midway through like that. And one of the biggest struggles for us was all of her personal items were still in her dorm room and, 700 and some miles away. So we had to figure out how we were going to get all of her personal belongings out of the dorm because they gave her a deadline date to do that. So we wound up having friends back home in Kansas. Went and picked everything up for us until we could get down there to get them. So personally, that's kind of how it's impacted me. The other thing I would say is my brain never gets to shut off. I feel like I'm constantly juggling and concerned and trying to keep everybody calm and positive through all of this. But it just never goes away. It is always there 24 hours a day, as it is for everyone in every profession, I would say.
So, going off that, it's probably hard to put something more specific to it, but, how have the number of hours you work each day been impacted and changed?
Initially, we were trying to just come in, get our work done, and get out, and then work from home the last couple hours of the day if we needed to. And we were kind of doing that with everybody, just because we felt if we could limit the time of exposure, that would be that much better for everyone, too. I don't know how many hours I spend on work. I'm going to say I've probably had, if you wanted a percentage, probably a 25 to 30% increase in my work time spent working. But it's okay. It's critical. And we know that we've got to really dig in and dig deep to keep the paper going.
I should have asked you for this from the get-go, but who is your ownership?
I am one of the owners, and then Nancy Seaton and Andrew Seaton are part of the Donald R. Seaton Trust. They are the majority owners, and then myself, and then there are other family members that are minor shareholders, but I'm the second largest shareholder.
So how much of a difference do you think it's made for you being truly locally owned compared to being part of a different chain?
Well, For one thing, we can make decisions hourly if we need to. And really, you know, in a business like ours, you're on constant deadlines and you're constantly planning, and you have this special section and you have that special section in addition to just our daily. And we publish Monday through Saturday. So it's a heavy load that we produce every day in addition to our special sections. It's the things that I've always known, but it probably is magnified even more when you're in a situation like we're in right now. If we had had somebody that was on the East Coast telling us what to do and how to do it, of course they would be making those decisions based on what was happening around them. And, you know, obviously New York City was hit terribly. You know, they're another this is another ground zero for them. And what was happening there is not what was happening here. We kind of had a joke that we said, as soon as we got our plan settled on and fixed on what we were going to do, then, you know, 5 minutes later it was changing. So I would say one thing about being locally owned is we're extremely dedicated to our communities because all of our employees live here, and myself included. So we truly have a deep commitment and connection to everyone. And we knew how critical it was going to be to get the information out to people on COVID and what was happening in each city and what regulations were happening and what people needed to do to be safe. And we take that role very, very seriously. And so we all knew we were just gonna have to work harder. So I would say for us, being local allows us to make what we feel are the best decisions for us and our community and how to operate. And my friends that are working for larger corporate newspapers have had to, they have those same commitments to their community, but they're at the mercy of what's happening to them corporate-wise. And that's anything from being forced to cut pages to being forced to cut, or page counts, you know, in their each edition, to cutting editions. There are some dailies that have gone down to 2 days a week, and I don't think they'll ever come back from that. To forcing workers to do working furloughs, where it's a rotating furlough, and it's brutal. They work for 3 weeks and then they're off for a week, and then they work for 3 weeks and they're off for a week. And during their furlough time, they're not allowed to look at their emails or talk to any employees or anything else. So that communication breaks down for that week. And then when they get back, they've got to hurry and get all their work done with the people that are there, because those people are probably going to be gone the next week. So I would not want to have to be trying to operate this with that kind of break in the chain of work and communication. I think it would just make it almost impossible.
So going off of that, have you had to make any kind of decisions as far as salary cuts or production changes?
We furloughed some people that we knew had either some health issues themselves, or they had family members that they were concerned about, that they needed to take care of. We really, because we're small enough and we all know each other well enough, we could be very human about it, which is something I've always prided myself on in the management of this business, that we try to be very human about things. And that is that family and safety is first and the newspaper second. We furloughed one of our ad staffers, one of our front office people, one of our sports editors, and one of our circulation folks. And then when business picks up, you know, when our workload picks up, we'll bring them back. But that took some pressure off of them, trying to work and then take care of their personal obligations. And then we did have one person in the office that did get COVID. She was in our newsroom, and she got it pretty early on, and she's had some major health issues as a result of it. And I am free to talk about it. I won't mention her name, but she wants us to talk openly about it so that other people can learn from what's gone on with her. But she's going into her 10th week of having, it's created kind of a little storm in her body. She's still trying to work, wants to work, has worked. She's still producing stories for us. But it's been really tough on her. And we've continued to pay her wages just like we normally would, because I don't want the finances to become another concern for her. So we've had it happen right in our small group of people. And so we've seen it firsthand, and it's brutal. Nobody wants it. She's only 36 years old. And so it was a surprise and to all of us, including her, that it hit her as hard as it did. So those are some of the things that we've done. We have not done any wage cuts or salary cuts. Not yet. I'm not saying that won't happen, but right now we're not doing that. We have reduced page counts in our paper. And by that, it's not all that noticeable, but we've just tightened it up. If there's not the ad support there, then we tighten that day up a little bit. But we also know that we've got to make sure it stays big enough that we can get all the information in there that everybody needs. We have not cut days of publication, and we will not cut days of publication. I do not want to break the daily habit of our readers. I want them to keep getting that paper every single day so that they form that habit and they want it. And the news is moving so fast and furious, we have to keep doing that in order to get everything out there that everybody needs to have access to. We do have a website. We've had a website for 25 years now. We're a very early adopter of websites. We've never put all of our stories on for free. We've always put just one or two out of our 40-some daily produced local stories. We've only just put one or two on. One thing that we did shift and do during this, though, is all of our COVID stories go up online and for free access. We felt it was too critical for all the public to have access to that information and have it at their fingertips and not have to pay for it. So we've done that. We've used social media to help push people to our website. And what we've found is over the last 3 months, we've gained almost 300 hard copy subscribers, which for a paper our size, that's a lot. That's a lot of subscribers to gain in a short amount of time. If you can gain 300 in a year, you're doing good. We've bucked the national trend at our paper for a long time, and I would say that I have seen this with other community papers as well. I just got done being the president of the South Dakota Newspaper Association. Earlier this month, I was the president for the last year. So I had an opportunity to talk to lots of other community papers around our state and other states. And community papers are doing really well. They're staying strong with subscribers and ad support. It's the big corporate papers that get in trouble because they start slashing their newsrooms. So we found if we continue to provide good information, accurate, factual, and relevant information, then you'll keep your subscribers. So that's what we've seen anyway. We've been able to keep subscribers, which helps. One thing we have done, though, is we have increased our subscription prices. We've had to. We've taken a 40% reduction in our ad revenue, and that's always help offset our expenses. And so when you take a big reduction like that, you're going to have to make up the revenue somewhere. So we did just implement a rate increase in June, and we'll probably have to do another one towards the end of the year. But I see that as possibly being a shift that's going to happen with newspapers. We're going to have to rely less on advertising revenue and more on subscription revenue. And so we've got to make sure we are offering a unique product that they want to pay for.
So you talked about increases in subscriptions. What have you seen as far as web traffic and social media traffic?
So on our web traffic, and what we do is we compare the month this year to the month last year. To get that. And from March through May, through the end of May, so those three main months of COVID, we saw a 40% increase in page views. We went over 1.2 million page views for our site during that time. That was a total of just over 600,000 sessions with folks. Our biggest spike month was in April. In May and March, we saw a 30% increase in our traffic, but in April, we saw a 91% increase in our traffic.
So talking a little bit more about news strategy, you mentioned at the beginning of our chat that you had somebody in sports move over to news. So talk about how the sports pages or lack thereof, how you filled that during this time.
So we weren't the only ones that had that. And this has been a pleasant surprise as well. In our Seton Publishing group of papers, family owned papers, there are seven newspapers. And we found that this happened in every single one of them. The ones that kept their sports guys, and I say the ones because we furloughed one of ours because he requested that he be. But our other sports reporter and then the sports reporters of those other papers all just shifted over to covering news or delivering papers or answering phones or selling subscriptions. I mean, they were more than willing to do whatever it took. And it was interesting to me to see how positive they were just across the board and how innovative they were because they wanted to keep sports information in the paper, just like you said, and then how willing they were to do whatever it took to keep the paper going. So they've really kind of been our rock stars out of all of our employees. Some of the ideas that we came up with early on that we've done, we were just at the end of some seasons, so we did wrap-ups like we always do for seasons. And then we decided, since the senior high school athletes were kind of getting gypped with the end of their year, not getting to do their sports banquets and their recognition, and some sports didn't even take place at all, like track and things like that, we went in and we did a feature on every senior athlete. And we just kind of did a photo and the sports they had participated in and awards they had received and just any standout things, and then interviewed them and got some quotes from them. So that, given all the high schools that we have, because we have four high schools that we cover, that took a lot of work and effort. But it was really well received by our readers. You know, they liked it too, because we all understood that, you know, prom went out the window, graduation has taken all forms between our four high schools. And that's always a big thing that we cover. And then certainly the athletes had a big disruption. One of the other items that we did for sports is we went back into the archives and pulled like classic stories. So things that, you know, state basketball championship that happened 35 years ago, we reran the story. And so we kind of did some reruns of major highlights. And we feared that would be something fun for people to talk about and something non-COVID related, because that's kind of always how sports are. It's a good escape for people. So we thought if they could relive some of those old classic moments, that would be fun for them too. So we did some of that in the beginning. Not so much now, because now there's stuff for us to cover. There is some baseball starting up, and then just talking about what fall sports are going to look like this year.
So going off, you know, your comment about non-COVID type of news, how much did your newsroom discuss trying to balance pandemic coverage while still providing coverage of normal things?
I'm sorry, I'm hesitating there. We knew that we didn't want all of our content to be COVID. We knew it was going to be heavy COVID, but we wanted to make sure we struck a balance, because you can wear the reader out, and you don't want them to get so bombarded that they start tuning it out. So one of our first strategies in our newsroom was, how are we going to cover governmental agencies? How are we going to cover city council and school board and county commission? And so we immediately, within the first few days there, I had written a letter to all of the different governmental entities that we cover. And because we're the legal publication for, it's right at, we're just under 30 different governmental entities. So it's a lot. And we didn't want them using this as an opportunity to shut us out or not let us attend the meeting, or, you know, what, however the meeting was going to take shape. Because again, there was no direction from state government on that, on how it should be handled. So most of them did a Zoom type meeting, and we made sure that they would allow us into those. Some kept meeting in person anyway, they just socially distanced. And so depending on which one that was, we went ahead and sent our reporter, made sure that they were being safe, that they weren't interacting closely with anybody, or they listened in on the broadcasts of them. But our letter clearly said that we, you know, we have a right and an obligation to be there. We expect to be there and be included. And we expected, if we have to do it remotely, we expect all of the participants to be available to us for questions. And we thought we might get a little bit of pushback from a couple of them. And it was completely the opposite. They were actually very not only welcoming, but they thanked us for being proactive about it, and thanked us for wanting to still be there, participate, report, and cover it, because they knew that what they were discussing was impacting the entire community, and they wanted to be very transparent about it. So I had talked to some newspapers that had some trouble with some of theirs, with a school board here or there, and even a city council, but we did not experience that at all. We have very good working relationships with them. They know that we're firm but fair, and they were all just on board to help us facilitate that however best we could. So they get an A+, and then the newsroom itself, we really made a conscious effort to just try to get other stories that weren't COVID related, which is kind of hard to do because almost everything's been impacted by it. But we tried to make it so that it wasn't the focus of the story.
So what were some of the biggest stories that your newsroom covered related to the pandemic? And I should follow up. I assume that your newsroom did a story about your own employee as well, or tell us more about that too.
Actually, we didn't, and we discussed it that we were going to do it, but we didn't, and mainly because she was still trying to work, and she took two COVID tests that came back negative, and she had three doctors tell her that she was getting a false negative. So that did become part of some of, I mean, we did talk about that, and we did talk about, because we did a story on the accuracy of tests and the fact that we had an employee that had three doctors tell her that she absolutely had it, but the tests were not accurate. And they were early on tests because she came down with symptoms within that first week or so, that first 7 to 10 days. So she had very early tests. In fact, there weren't even tests available when she first went in. And then we slowly started getting them. And she had an ER doctor and then two other specialists tell her that she absolutely had it, even though she's not being, quote, counted as one that has it. So we had talked about it. And what we were going to do is have her tell the story first person perspective until, but we thought that she'd be sick for just a few weeks and then we would do it, and she's still not over it. So that's why we haven't done that one. Some of the other stories that we've done that are COVID related that I'm particularly proud of by our staff is Wendy Pitlick. That she works out of, she lives up in Lead and works from home. And she did a story on Dr. John Andrews, and she did that back in late March, is when that story published. But Dr. Andrews is a retired medical researcher and scientist. He has a doctorate, he has three doctorates, one in virology, one in immunology, and one in microbiology. And he had a 50 plus year career. And he worked on the AIDS epidemic even. He's been in the middle of almost every major type pandemic type outbreak or major outbreak. He worked on SARS, et cetera. And he retired and moved to Lead about 2 years ago. And when this all broke loose, he came out of retirement to work specifically on COVID. And so the first story she did with him was just, she hit it out of the park. It was so good, so extremely informative. And for such a negative subject, it was such a positive result because you felt like, wow, here's somebody that really knows what they're doing that's working on it. And that turned into him being, he writes a column for us every other week now on how their research is going, what they're learning about the virus, and what the prognosis is and outlook is. So that was one of the stories that we did initially, and then it's been ongoing. We did a three-part story. Mark Watson, our editor here in Spearfish, did a three-part story with Dr. Andrew Van Ostall, and he works out of the Spearfish Hospital, which is called Monument Hospital. And he gave us that really rare opportunity that you don't get enough anymore as a reporter. And he spoke very openly and honestly about what he was seeing and what was happening. And he gave us, he gave us the brutal reality of what happens when you get it and what it's like to be intubated, I'm sorry, or on a respirator. And, it's a really ugly, ugly disease. People that compare it to flu haven't allowed themselves to see what really happens to people. So we got a lot of positive feedback from that series of three stories with him. from our readers, but because they felt like that absolutely needed to be shared and be out there. It feels like a lot of the national coverage is sterile and talks about superficial things, but it doesn't talk about the brutal reality of this wicked thing. And then that was in April. And then our third story that we did towards the end of May here was with Dr. Nag, and Professor Nag. He's a professor and has his doctorate at Black Hills State University, which is our local college. And he's a math professor. And he did a really fascinating piece with us on the probability of infection for people when they're wearing a mask and the probability of infection when people social distance and how that impacts. And it looked like a formula right out of the Big Bang Theory TV show. And we had him draw it out for us even. It's a very complicated mathematical formula for the probabilities. But again, it was someone driving home for us how susceptible we all are, how vulnerable we are all are. And by just practicing some of these basic measures and procedures, you can protect yourself. It bears that I should mention this too. We're in a partnership with South Dakota News Watch, which is a nonprofit news organization that tackles statewide stories and investigative stories. And it was established a little over 3 years ago now. And I also serve on their board of directors, but they provide stories for free for newspapers, radio, and television, and their enterprise stories. And so some of the stories that they provided to us that we felt were really strong and beneficial to our readers were, they did an early story about inadequate testing, something that I just touched on. And then the major outbreak that happened in Sioux Falls at the meatpacking plant was another big story that they ran that everybody was talking about in the state anyway, but there's nothing like having it in print and having all the data right there in front of you to go back and reference anytime you want. And then their other big story was on, because of the COVID virus impacting these meatpacking and meat processing plants so heavily, and the fact that we're very much an agricultural state, we had lots of producers that were having to euthanize livestock, and specifically hogs, because there just was no place to take them for them to be processed. So that was a pretty hard story, but necessary story to tell as well.
You touched on this earlier, but how do you see the business model for the industry changing as a result of this?
It might be too early for me to be able to predict that fully. I am a huge proponent of newspapers and print and hard copy and having a permanent record. Because we provide the permanent record of history for what happens in the communities. Sound bites do that. They go off into the air. And somebody has to go search them out and find them. So I feel that newspapers' roles in the community of protecting democracy and making sure government does the right thing and transparency and how funds are being spent, I feel like that will stay important. If anything, it probably makes our role that much more obviously critical to the public. And we've certainly heard that in feedback. I've been thanked numerous times by countless subscribers. I've been thanked that we keep producing the paper every day. Some papers have had to make tough decisions and cut back. And I don't think those papers will ever go back to being a daily. I think once you've started making those cuts in your product, you probably won't add back to it. So that scares me for the newspaper industry going forward, because what we do is important, and what we do is important on a daily basis. And I think if we switch to the web, there's a million sites out there competing for people's attention. So we just become one more thing in the digital noise that's out there trying to grab attention. Having a printed copy is what makes us unique. So there's a part of me that I'm worried about people taking a quick, and I don't want to say easy because I don't think anybody takes it lightly, but they take a quick, kind of simple approach to trying to cut costs, where I think they need to be figuring out how they can bring in more revenue. I see some of these newsrooms may permanently have their reporters work from home and not have them come back into the office. And I think that's a really bad idea as well, because you have to have that rejuvenation and energy and idea exchange that you can only get when you all gather together. And not only that, it's not all serious. Newsrooms are a lot of fun. We laugh and joke and we lighten things up, and that's equally important. We have serious jobs, but I want everybody to come to work and have fun when they come to work and get a good laugh when they're at work and let some of that stress go away. So I am a firm believer in the newsroom, but I'm afraid those days might be limited. And then revenue-wise, I'm not sure what's going to happen to the advertising portion of our business. Our ads work really, really well. I can rattle off a dozen people that will tell you how they get so many phone calls off of their ads, they don't know what to do with all of them. I just had somebody call me yesterday to ask me to pull their ad because they were getting too many phone calls. And that was a person in the agricultural industry. We have a gentleman that owns a mobile home and manufactured home business out of Rapid City, and the last ad he ran with us, he got 18 phone calls off of it, and 12 of those people came into his business to purchase. So print works. Print is powerful. That doesn't mean that I ignored the digital part of it. Obviously, you can subscribe to our paper through e-edition, and you can read our information, at least parts of it, online on websites. But and I'm not precious about print. If all of our subscribers decided they wanted an e-edition, fine, we would switch over to that. But print is still extremely powerful, and it's unique. And all the things have always been the strong suits of print are still there. So I hope that our industry can come through this and they don't give up on themselves. We've had a lot of struggles over the years and a lot of disruptors. So this is just one more in a long line of them, but I know it's a serious one. I've never wanted to cut our reporters. If anything, when I became publisher in 2010, the first talk that I had with our editor was I didn't care if I saw another Associated Press story in our paper or not. That's not why people were subscribing. They subscribed to our paper to get local news. So we added reporters. And that's been our goal all along, is to add reporters, add more stringers, add more columnists that are local. So we've just done everything we can to become a hyper local paper. People can go on the internet and find out what happened with the president or with Congress and, you know, a thousand different media outlets, but they can't go anywhere else to get what we provide every day. So as long as we do our job, we should be okay. The major shift that I do see happening is probably what we talked about earlier, which is revenue shift. I really need to get our paper to a point where it can be sustained, get everything covered with subscription costs so that advertising becomes the profit area. If I sell an ad, then I make a profit. I have talked to some other papers that have been working towards that, and that's what they're doing. So the days of us giving our paper away cheap or selling our paper at just enough to cover circulation costs and then having advertising cover everything else, those days are probably gone. And I think we were already going towards that. This just sped it up and is making people make tough decisions right now. So I'm not going to apologize about raising subscription rates. I'm going to keep doing it until somebody cries uncle, because I've got to get the money somewhere. And I absolutely think our paper is worth well more than what we charge for it.
You mentioned readers thanking you. So on top of the pandemic, of course, we are also in a time as a media industry where some people consider us an enemy of the people, and there is significant distrust in the media. So what kind of changes, if any, have you noticed with your reader base during the pandemic?
I think they're more forthright about telling us when they like something or, you know, commenting on a specific story or what we do. It's funny, I always, when people bash the media, I always defend the media. And their next comment is, well, we're not talking about you. We're talking about, you know, national, the TV networks and the Washington Post and the New York Times. And I said, well, but you don't say that. You throw us all in together. And I understand why the consumer feels like sometimes the media is slanted or has an agenda. They're always quick to say that we don't do that and that more people should be like us, et cetera. Now, they're going to say that to me because I'm the publisher, but I think they mean it. I don't think they're just saying it. We certainly get criticism too. And I welcome criticism. I want it because I want to be a better paper. I feel like what's happened in the media landscape is the consumer doesn't understand when something is a news piece and when something is an opinion piece. And one thing about newspapers, we have an opinion editorial page, and that's the only place that we're supposed to have opinion. And we really strive hard to not insert our opinion into stories. We leave it for those pages or those columns. I think there's such a blur in the national media landscape, especially with 24-hour news channels. They're trying to fill time. And so you get a lot of people coming on to give their opinion, to create a discussion, but it doesn't feel that way to the consumer. So we all could do a better job of making sure the consumer understands when it's news and when it's opinion. One thing that we're doing with South Dakota News Watch, just to go back to them again, that's the organization I talked about earlier. This is the nonprofit statewide news coverage. They're doing a town hall meeting tonight, even on Zoom, where anyone can come in and talk about COVID and how it's impacted them personally, their community, and what we need to do going forward. And so those are the things that we really need to do as media companies, is encourage that civil discourse and discussion amongst our citizens on how we tackle the big issues. So I'm really proud that Newswatch is doing that, and that I, along with the other 100 plus papers in the state that participate with them, are also encouraging that, because I think it's really important.
How has the pandemic influenced you personally?
I'm tired. That's one thing it's done. I feel like a lot of my time is spent trying to make sure that I'm doing the right thing, that I'm keeping our employees safe, that our carriers are safe, that our work environment is safe. Personally, I've been very fortunate. I haven't been sick. No one in my family has been sick. My mother is in her late 70s, and she's suffering from dementia, Alzheimer's. And so it's been hard explaining to her what's going on and why we've had to change what we're doing. And I've seen a decline in her specifically because of the isolation, and so much so that we're going to be moving her into assisted living this next week, so that she can have more care that way. So that's been a pretty major impact on me, trying to take care of her and in addition to everything else that I'm doing, and making sure that she's okay and that she feels safe and secure too. And then just keeping our kids informed. You know, I'm a real believer in information, but you got to make sure it doesn't scare you. You know, information is power, and that should take away the fear of the unknown when you understand what's happening a little bit better. So I guess that answers your question, I think, unless you want me to touch on something else.
How has the pandemic influenced your views of the role of journalism in society?
That we're more important than ever before. There's just so much misinformation out there in the world. Too many people get information by comic memes and social media and little blips and sound bites, and people not only need it, they want to have a reliable, factual resource that they know they can count on being there. And we've got to do that. We've got to do the best job that we can. And especially with something like this, where it changes so much. And I think everybody's been frustrated with that, because we're seeing a major virus not only making people sick, but killing large numbers of people. And just when the scientists think they understand it, you know, things change with it. And we're impatient in this country. Americans are just naturally impatient. And I think we're too hard sometimes on the people working on this, and our expectations are awfully high. So I feel like media's role is to be the calming voice of reason and to just make sure that people are informed and not panicked.
So you mentioned being really ready for your staff to be able to go back to the newsroom, but what are some changes to your operations during the pandemic that you think will continue once it's over?
Well, we're going to keep cleaning our office very thoroughly. That's one of the things that we've changed, and we will continue to do that. And we basically Lysol everything down in the morning, throughout the day, and then again at night. And the other thing that's changed is I think people really understand if you don't feel well, you stay home. And we've highly encouraged that. And we've had a few people that got a headache unexpectedly and had it for a day or two. And so it made them nervous. So they stayed home. And we're paying them regardless because I don't want them to feel like they have to come in that way. And that's only happened a few times. I think that we'll use some of our digital communication more. The Zoom meetings have been really good. They're more efficient. And especially in a big state like ours, and when I serve on numerous boards like I do, I spend a lot of time driving. And so I haven't minded this at all, having Zoom meetings, because I can go right back to work when I'm done instead of getting in my car and driving for 3 hours. So I think that is probably going to change how our businesses operate. And I'm not sure. I try to predict the future somewhat, but it's more important to stay flexible and be willing to move with the changes, because just when you think you have this one figured out, it changes on you.
So going back to readers, what do you want readers to know about journalism right now?
That we strive every day to be fair and factual and impartial. That the journalism profession is full of people that truly are dedicated and truly care about making sure that people have solid information to go on in all aspects of their life. Not only are we a government watchdog, but we're newspapers specifically are here to celebrate the births, the weddings, the anniversaries, the business milestones, the funny stories, the war veteran stories, all of that. We're here to tell the story of all the people in our communities, and we take that role very seriously, and we're proud to do it, and we want to keep doing it because we know we make a real impactful, positive difference in the lives of the communities. We're the glue for the communities.
What do you want journalists 100 years from now who may be covering a new pandemic? What do you want them to know?
That we've been through tough times before, many times, and we'll be through them again, and that they can do this. I tend to kind of like to have sayings, motivational sayings, and I use them. I use them in our office. I use them for myself personally. Then the one that I came up with early on that I've used a lot, that I've had people ask me to text to them because they read it now every morning. So my saying this time was calm, caution, compassion, and communication. And if you can remember those four things every day, and maybe you start your day off that way, or if things are starting to feel overwhelming and you feel anxiety coming in, you remind yourself, if we can all practice those four things, we can get through this. Because panic doesn't do anybody any good. Fear doesn't do anybody any good. Being flippant about things, acting you don't care, or it acting like it's just the flu, that doesn't help. That's where my caution comes in. Compassion, by definition of that, I mean, remember that people are going through personal things as well as professional things. And they might be short-tempered, or they might not have the reaction that you expect them to. But we need to be compassionate, and we need to not be angry that people aren't doing what we think they should be doing. Everybody's trying to do their best. I really do believe that. And it doesn't do you any good to get mad about it. And then communication, and I think that one's obvious. Be clear about your expectations and what you want done and how you expect things to be done. So that's something that I would suggest going forward when you get in a hot spot is those four words: calm, caution, compassion, communication.
Is there anything else you wanted to talk about?
I think we covered it all. I don't have anything off the top of my head unless there's anything else that came up to you.
Okay, well, this is the conclusion of the oral history.